Chapter 49. Had been no slip twixt cup and lip in this case, that Elizabeth Jane and Donald Farfrae were man and wife. Hensher did not care to ride any further with his chattering companions, after hearing this sound. Indeed, it quite unmanned him, and in pursuance of his plan of not showing himself in Casterbridge Street till evening, lest he should mortify Farfrae and his bride, he alighted here, with his bundle and birdcage, and was soon left as a lonely figure on the broad white highway. It was the hill near which he had waited to meet Farfrae, almost 2 years earlier, to tell him of the serious illness of his wife Lucetta. The place was unchanged. The same larches sighed the same notes. But Farfrae had another wife, and, as Hensher knew, a better one. He only hoped that Elizabeth Jane had obtained a better home than had been hers at the former time. He passed the remainder of the afternoon in a curious high-strung condition, unable to do much but think of the approaching meeting with her, and sadly satirize himself for his emotions thereon, as a Samson shorn. Such an innovation on Casterbridge customs as a flitting of bridegroom and bride from the town immediately after the ceremony was not likely, but if it should have taken place he would wait till their return. To assure himself on this point he asked a market man when near the borough if the newly married couple had gone away, and was promptly informed that they had not. They were at that hour, according to all accounts, entertaining a houseful of guests at their home in Corn Street. Hensher dusted his boots, washed his hands at the riverside, and proceeded up the town under the feeble lamps. He need have made no inquiries beforehand, for on drawing near Farfrae's residence it was plain to the least observant that festivity prevailed within, and that Donald himself shared it, his voice being distinctly audible in the street, giving strong expression to a song of his dear native country that he loved so well as never to have revisited it. Idlers were standing on the pavement in front, and wishing to escape the notice of these Hensher passed quickly on to the door. It was wide open, the hall was lighted extravagantly, and people were going up and down the stairs. His courage failed him. To enter footsore, laden, and poorly dressed into the midst of such resplendency was to bring needless humiliation upon her he loved, if not to court repulse from her husband. Accordingly he went round into the street at the back, that he knew so well, entered the garden, and came quietly into the house through the kitchen, temporarily depositing the bird and cage under a bush outside, to lessen the awkwardness of his arrival. Solitude and sadness had so emaliated Hensher that he now feared circumstances he would formerly have scorned, and he began to wish that he had not taken upon himself to arrive at such a juncture. However, his progress was made unexpectedly easy by his discovering alone in the kitchen an elderly woman who seemed to be acting as provisional housekeeper during the convulsions from which Farfrae's establishment was just then suffering. She was one of those people whom nothing surprises, and though to her, a total stranger, his request must have seemed odd, she willingly volunteered to go up and inform the master and mistress of the house that humble old friend had come. On second thought she said that he had better not wait in the kitchen, but come up into the little back parlor, which was empty. He thereupon followed her thither, and she left him. Just as she got across the landing to the door of the best parlor a dance was struck up, and she returned to say that she would wait till that was over before announcing him, Mr. and Mrs. Farfrae having both joined in the figure. The door of the front room had been taken off its hinges to give more space, and that of the room Hensher sat in being ajar, he could see fractional parts of the dancers, whenever their gyrations brought them near the doorway, chiefly in the shape of the skirts of dresses and streaming curls of hair, together with about 3/5 of the band in profile, including the restless shadow of a fiddler's elbow, and the tip of the bass viol bow. The gaiety jarred upon Hensher's spirits, and he could not quite understand why Farfrae, a much sobered man, and a widower, who had had his trials, should have cared for it all, notwithstanding the fact that he was quite a young man still, and quickly kindled to enthusiasm by dance and song. That the quiet Elizabeth, who had long ago appraised life at a moderate value, and who knew in spite of her maidenhood, that marriage was as a rule no dancing matter, should have had zest for this revelry surprised him still more. However, young people could not be quite old people, he concluded, and custom was omnipotent. With the progress of the dance the performers spread out somewhat, and then for the first time he caught a glimpse of the once despised daughter who had mastered him, and made his heart ache. She was in a dress of white silk or satin, he was not near enough to say which snowy white, without a tinge of milk or cream, and the expression of her face was one of nervous pleasure, rather than of gaiety. Presently Farfrae came round, his exuberant Scotch movement making him conspicuous in a moment. The pair were not dancing together, but Henchard could discern that, whenever the chances of the figure made them the partners of a moment, their emotions breathed a much subtler essence than at other times. By degrees Henchard became aware that the measure was trod by someone who out-farfraed Farfrae in saltatory intenseness. This was strange, and it was stranger to find that the eclipsing personage was Elizabeth Jane's partner. The first time that Henchard saw him, he was sweeping grandly round, his head quivering and low down, his legs in the form of antennae, and his back towards the door. The next time he came round in the other direction, his white waistcoat preceding his face, and his toes preceding his white waistcoat. That happy face Henchard's complete discomfiture lay in it. It was Newsons, who had indeed come and supplanted him. Henchard pushed to the door, and for some seconds made no other movement. He rose to his feet, and stood like a dark ruin, obscured by the shade from his own soul upthrown. But he was no longer the man to stand these reverses unmoved. His agitation was great, and he would fain have been gone, but before he could leave the dance had ended, the housekeeper had informed Elizabeth Jane of the stranger who awaited her, and she entered the room immediately. "Oh, it is Mr. Henchard," she said, starting back. "What, Elizabeth," he cried, as she seized her hand. "What do you say, Mr. Henchard? Don't scourge me like that. Call me worthless old Henchard anything but don't be so cold as this. Oh, my maid, I see you have another a real father in my place. Then you know all, but don't give all your thought to him. Do ye save a little room for me?" She flushed up, and gently drew her hand away. "Could have loved you always I would have, gladly," she said. "But how can I, when I know you have deceived me so bitterly deceived me? You persuaded me that my father was not my father, allowed me to live on in ignorance of the truth for years, and then when he, my warm-hearted real father, came to find me, cruelly sent him away with a wicked invention of my death, which nearly broke his heart. Oh, how can I love as I once did a man who has served us like this?" Henchard's lips half parted to begin an explanation, but he shut them up like a vice, and uttered not a sound. How should he, there and then, set before her with any effect the palliatives of his great faults, that he had himself been deceived in her identity at first, till informed by her mother's letter that his own child had died, that, in the second accusation, his lie had been the last desperate throw of a gamester who loved her affection better than his own honor? Among the many hindrances to such a pleading, not the least was this, that he did not sufficiently value himself to lessen his sufferings by strenuous appeal or elaborate argument. Waiving, therefore, his privilege of self-defense, he regarded only his discomposure. "Aunt, ye distress yourself on my account," he said, with proud superiority. "Would not wish it at such a time to, as this. I have done wrong in coming. To ye I see my error, but it is only for once, so forgive it. I'll never trouble ye again, Elizabeth Jane, no, not to my dying day. Good night. Goodbye." Then, before she could collect her thoughts, Hedgehog went out from her rooms, and departed from the house by the back way as he had come, and she saw him no more. 45. It was about a month after the day which closed as in the last chapter. Elizabeth Jane had grown accustomed to the novelty of her situation, and the only difference between Donald's movements now and formerly was that he hastened indoors rather more quickly after business hours than he had been in the habit of doing for some time. Newson had stayed in Casterbridge 3 days after the wedding party, whose gaiety, as might have been surmised, was of his making, rather than of the married couple's, and was stared at and honored as became the returned Crusoe of the hour. But whether or not because Casterbridge was difficult to excite by dramatic returns and disappearances through having been for centuries an assize town, in which sensational exits from the world, antipodean absences, and such like, were half yearly occurrences, the inhabitants did not altogether lose their equanimity on his account. On the fourth morning he was discovered disconsolately climbing a hill, in his craving to get a glimpse of the sea from somewhere or other. The contiguity of salt water proved to be such a necessity of his existence, that he preferred Budmouth as a place of residence, notwithstanding the society of his daughter in the other town. Thither he went, and settled in lodgings in a green-shuttered cottage which had a bow window, jutting out sufficiently to afford glimpses of a vertical strip of blue sea to anyone opening the sash, and leaning forward far enough to look through a narrow lane of tall intervening houses. Elizabeth Jane was standing in the middle of her upstairs parlor, critically surveying some rearrangement of articles with her head to one side, when the housemaid came in with the announcement, "Oh, please ma'am, we know now how that birdcage came there." In exploring her new domain during the first week of residence, gazing with critical satisfaction on this cheerful room and that, penetrating cautiously into dark cellars, sallying forth with gingerly tread to the garden, now leaf-strewn by autumn winds, and thus, like a wise field marshal, estimating the capabilities of the site whereon she was about to open her housekeeping campaign, Mrs. Donald Farfrae had discovered in a screened corner a new birdcage, shrouded in newspaper, and at the bottom of the cage a little ball of feathers, the dead body of a goldfinch. Nobody could tell her how the bird and cage had come there, though that the poor little songster had been starved to death was evident. The sadness of the incident had made an impression on her. As he had not been able to forget it for days, despite Farfrae's tender banter, and now when the matter had been nearly forgotten it was again revived. "Oh, please ma'am, we know how the bird cage came there. That farmer's man who called on the evening of the wedding, he was seen with it in his hand as he came up the street, and 'tis thoughted that he put it down while he came in with his message, and then went away forgetting where he had left it." This was enough to set Elizabeth thinking, and in thinking she seized hold of the idea, at one feminine bound, that the caged bird had been brought by Henchard for her as a wedding gift and token of repentance. He had not expressed to her any regrets or excuses for what he had done in the past, but it was a part of his nature to extenuate nothing, and live on as one of his own worst accusers. She went out, looked at the cage, buried the starved little singer, and from that hour her heart softened towards the self-alienated man. When her husband came in she told him her solution of the birdcage mystery, and begged Donald to help her in finding out, as soon as possible, whither Henchard had banished himself, that she might make her peace with him, try to do something to render his life less that of an outcast, and more tolerable to him. Although Farfrae had never so passionately liked Henchard as Henchard had liked him, he had, on the other hand, never so passionately hated in the same direction as his former friend had done, and he was therefore not the least indisposed to assist Elizabeth Jane in her laudable plan. But it was by no means easy to set about discovering Henchard. He had apparently sunk into the earth on leaving Mr. and Mrs. Farfrae's door. Elizabeth Jane remembered what he had once attempted, and trembled. but though she did not know it, Henchard had become a changed man since then. As far, that is, as change of emotional basis can justify such a radical phrase, and she needed not to fear. In a few days, Farfrae's inquiries elicited that Henchard had been seen by one who knew him walking steadily along the Melchester Highway eastward, at 12 o'clock at night, in other words, retracing his steps on the road by which he had come. This was enough, and the next morning Farfrae might have been discovered driving his gig out of Casterbridge in that direction, Elizabeth Jane sitting beside him, wrapped in a thick flat fur, the Victorian of the period, her complexion somewhat richer than formerly, and an incipient matronly dignity, which the serene Minerva eyes of one whose gestures beamed with mind made becoming, settling on her face. Having herself arrived at a promising haven from at least the grosser troubles of her life, her object was to place Henchard in some similar quietude, before he should sink into that lower stage of existence which was only too possible to him now. After driving along the highway for a few miles, they made further inquiries, and learned of a road mender, who had been working thereabouts for weeks, that he had observed such a man at the time mentioned. He had left the Melchester coach road at Weatherbury by a forking highway which skirted the north of Egdon Heath. Into this road they directed the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.